This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. For poet Larry Johnson, inspiration can strike anywhere. A passing phrase from a favorite teacher, a quote from a book on an ancient hero, or even a refuge for displaced tigers. Larry Johnson's latest volume holds references to all of those muses, plus emperors, Vikings, Keats, and Godzilla. Besides being a poet, Larry Johnson teaches English at Wake Technical Community College in Raleigh. His new volume of poetry is called Alloy, and he joins us now. Larry Johnson, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Tell us about your interest in poetry, because it does marry an interest, it seems to me, in history, particularly ancient history.
That's right. I became interested in the Romans in high school, I guess, and other kinds of history as well, but especially the Romans, and so it seemed to me to be a worthy subject for writing poetry, and I've continued to do that for 40 years or so, writing poems about the Romans, as well as other writers and important figures I'm impressed with.
Were you interested in poetry at about the same time you became interested in Roman history?
Well, I became even more interested in poetry about that time in high school. But I've seemed like I've always wanted to write poetry, even when I was much younger than that. I wrote some gibberish or doggerel or whatever you want to call it that passed for poetry.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Ibsen said you have to write a bad play before you write a good one. So
that's right. There were lots of bad ones before the good ones.
Would you read a poem for us now?
Yes, I would. Which one is that?
Well, how about Alexandria Escate? And you can tell us a little bit about that.
All right. One thing I don't like is poems that the explanation of which take longer than the poem itself, but I'll try to.
But since I don't know what that means, you have to.
Well, Alexander the Great, as you know, established many cities called Alexandria all over Asia. And the one he established furthest north in Asia, which is now Tajikistan, was called Alexandria Escate, that is, Alexandria the Furthest. After that, he marched on to India, and his men revolted after he made a conquest there, and he had to take them home through the desert where many died. And he made it back to Babylon, where he died soon after. But he would leave veterans in these cities whose time was up. In this poem, one of the veterans speaks about being left here and not going on to India, but that might have been a good thing. And then he left us, exhausted, the only ones abandoned to these scabrous desert heights, moon cold but later seared in blinding suns, making us sightless through both days and nights. He crunched away down scaly ochre slopes, flaming dust in our faces, the furthest we, alone with mud bricks, nomads, abundant hopes not marching to moldy India, God-roaring sea. We heard his men squall, mad in endless rain, revolted, faced hell's bowels just to walk west. Now at Babylon he's clutched the final gain, Olympus. We pray his ambition not infest the gods' minds, begin celestial wars. This east is terror enough, its crag-bound stars.
Larry Johnson reading from his latest volume of poems, Alloy. I love that. I love that image. Crag-bound stars looking through the, Himalayan mountains?
Right.
Watching them, sort of the stars.
Surrounded by mountains.
Beautiful, beautiful imagery. When does this soldier come to life for you? We know Alexander the Great. We can imagine his exploits. But this one soldier left behind, when does he come alive for you?
Well, I had actually planned to write this poem. This is one of the few poems I had planned to write for years without ever writing it. But I had always had the first words there, and then he left us. Those words were in my mind for many years that I wanted to be the opening line of this poem. I finally got around to writing it and making a sonnet out of it, as you saw. But you can't help but feel sorry for these guys who are left behind, even if their time in the army was up. They're left in this godforsaken wilderness, as it were, and they didn't get to go on to India, even if the monsoon rains there drove Alexander's men mad. No Westerner had ever faced those before. So men left behind like that. Yeah. They came alive for me.
Would you read another one for us? How about Sympathy for Gallienus, who is somebody else you're going to have to tell us a little bit about?
All right. The Emperor Gallienus, Roman Emperor, 253 to 268. He's one of my favorite emperors. He ruled in the middle of that 50-year period of civil war in the 3rd century. And the Persians invaded the east. He had to let the Palmyran king Odenathus sort of take care of the east for him while he fought the usurper Posthumus in the west and fought the Goths as well. But he was a disciple of Plotinus, the philosopher, and a friend of his. But his life was considered by some of the Augustan historians to be too promiscuous for their taste, and even Edward Gibbon picked that up from them, but it turns out with research not to have been true. So it's called Sympathy for Gallienus. My favorite emperor? He employed Plotinus and wrote poetry, though that stale Porcinus who portrayed Augustine's gave him a bum rap and even infected Gibbon with his crap. Perhaps not, but having had to loan the east to Odenathus for safekeeping, the beast Posthumus having lately killed his son, who could blame him for seeking a little fun through the yellow veil of his German mistress's hair, or from his philosopher, strict doctrinaire who taught reality was the scum of dream? Rallied, he skewered the Goths in a supreme labor at Nisus to save some undecayed flesh of empire. But he fell at Milan, betrayed by generals acclaiming Claudius with a roar. Claudius II, that is, a stifling bore.
Sympathy for Gallienus, a poem in the Book of Poems, Alloy, by Larry Johnson. First of all, may I say, I love talking to a man who has a favorite emperor. It's a rare treat. But secondly, the idea that you would, on further research, you know, I mean, history at the time was a profession really about glorifying particular heroes, perhaps setting moral standards, a little less than objective in terms of its origins. How do we sort through? And then what is the record beyond what those contemporary historians did, and then a guy like Gibbon who sorts through their work to come up with his?
Well, you have to look at some of the other historians of the time, some were a little more honest than the historians in the so-called Augustan history.
We're still dealing with filters on filters on filters.
Right. Archaeology helps us out some with these things, but these Augustan historians were trying to glorify the Emperor Claudius II, and they were also trying to glorify the present emperor, Constantine, who claimed to be descended from Claudius II, but was not actually. So they would denigrate the predecessors to Claudius, and Gallienus, having been one of those predecessors, he was thought to have a dissolute lifestyle, and this propaganda was passed on. And so Gibbon, having nothing else to work with, sometimes, but these historians bought into some of this denigration and.
Or crap, as you so poetically put it in your
right.
work. This is, well, and it takes a poet to set the record straight. And I think that's another important element in this, that a poetic interpretation is as good as any kind of so-called historic interpretation. I want to make sure we have time to read Protestant Grave, if you would.
All right. John Keats' grave is, of course, at the Protestant Cemetery in Rome, where he died. And when I went there, I didn't realize it was now a sanctuary for stray and homeless cats. And when I saw Keats' grave first, it had three big, beautiful black cats around the grave, which I thought was immensely cool. So I eventually wrote a poem about it. It's called Protestant Grave. I was pleased to read that John Keats, the much-orphaned medical student who was born on Halloween, once stopped on his way classward to thrash a boy who was torturing a cat. I can see short, feisty Keats pummeling the scrawny punk, booting his Cossacks away, then kneeling to give the animal what succor he could before going on to his cadavers. Pleased because, when I visited the poet's grave and discovered the cemetery is now also a sanctuary where homeless cats are fed and protected, my first sight was three sleek, huge black felines, lazing, curling magisterially around the grave. I was impressed then, though sentiment surely helped. But what liquid midnight manes roiled protectively on the grass. Manes, of course, being the Latin word for the spirits of the dead.
This poem is to me, in some ways, uncharacteristic of some of your other works in the way these images tend to roil and are a little more, ephemeral and morphing from one form into another.
That's part of the alloy, I hope.
That's the alloy. Also, I admire any poet who can use the word. Dan, you said Cossacks, but I've always heard it pronounced Cossacks. Cossacks, which is that little bone, the tailbone, right?
Right.
We all, those of us of a certain age, remember when Johnny Carson discovered that word and couldn't let go of it. So that's very... Also, John Keats, so in getting ready for this, I thought, I better read up on Keats a little bit. So what I learned is there is a Bo Peep, England, and he vacationed there.
How about that?
Well, anyway, it's wonderful. I'm sorry for the diversion there, but it's a terrific poem. And is that part of the alloy, the fact that these forms, because you're known for a kind of a strict and wonderful classic form and contemporary themes, and yet here we're seeing images drift, cats into sort of wave-like forms. Is that the alloy?
I think so. I think that's part of it. Going on to his cadavers, his medical cadavers there. And he was orphaned twice. His actual parents died, and then his adopted parents died. So much orphaned.
Terrific poetry, Larry. So good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Larry Johnson, a poet and English professor at Wake Technical Community College. His latest book, Alloy. You can find out more about that and everything we talk about at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director. Our news director is Brent Wolf. And this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.